You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, nearly 300 incarcerated people in Wisconsin have tested positive for COVID-19. We'll find out where the prison system is on requiring face masks and how inmates' families are feeling about the dangers posed by the coronavirus. First, with elections coming up in August and November, UW-Madison is ramping up efforts to help students vote. It's joined a nationwide initiative called the All-In Campus Democracy Challenge. The goal is to get as many students registered to vote as possible. But with the coronavirus pandemic turning polling places into a potential health risk, the university will also emphasize absentee voting. Kathy Kramer is a political science professor at UW-Madison and the chairwoman of Badgers Vote, which coordinates the university's voter education efforts. Kathy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rob.
I know a handful of campuses around the state are participating in this nationwide voting challenge. Can you talk about how it works and how you at UW-Madison got involved in it?
Sure. Well, UW-Madison, thankfully, has been involved since 2016 when it started up. It started up in the summer of 2016. But just recently, Chancellor Becky Blank has signed on a renewal saying, yes, we want to be a part of this challenge. And basically what happens is about 1,000 higher ed institutions across the country compete to see who can have the highest voting rates and registration rates among their students, as well as who can have the most improved rates of each of those. So it's an incentive for us to get our act together and give students all the information that they need in order to participate in their democracy.
Now, since this is a competitive event, how has UW-Madison stacked up nationwide over the last few years?
Well, we've done pretty well. And I can tell you specifically, the Big Ten Voting Challenge is kind of a sub-component of this. And in 2018, we did pretty well in the overall Big Ten Challenge, where Minnesota beat us out a bit in terms of overall voting rate. But our voting rate was pretty high, especially for college students. We had about a 53% turnout rate in 2018. Now, mind you, that was an off-year election, not a presidential election, and we can expect to have an even higher voting rate in the presidential election coming up.
Why this focus for the university on making sure students get involved in voting?
Well, it sort of goes just hand in hand with the overall mission of a great public university like the University of Wisconsin-Madison, in that when the people of the state decided that they wanted a university system, they did it in part because they needed to educate people and try to figure out how to be self-governing, how to create a great state in which the people of the state had a say in the direction of the state. So it was partly to train people in how to do great agriculture, how to build an economy, how to build the infrastructure that we needed here. But the university exists in part to make sure that our democracy persists. And voting is the most basic civic act. So we need to help young people understand what they need to do in order to participate. And one of the other thing I'll say as a political scientist is that we know that if you vote as a young person, you are likely to continue voting across the course of your life. And so it's just a really important time for most college students who tend to be young people to understand what it means to register and to get to the polls on election day or vote absentee.
For any generation, I think there's a perception, maybe a myth, I don't know, that younger people are apathetic. They don't care about voting. They don't get involved till later in life. In your work with students on the UW-Madison campus, do you find that to be the case?
Well, it varies a lot. And it generally is the case that people tend to sit up and take notice once they start paying taxes and move into the workforce and have families. So that is true that people tend to vote a bit more after the typical college age. But there's a range of levels of involvement on the UW-Madison campus. We tend to see the lowest voting rates in the so-called STEM disciplines. In the social sciences, students can be very, very engaged in elections. In our School of Ed, there's some extraordinarily high turnout rates. So it just varies. And, you know, in my own classes as a political science professor, I see a lot of interest in politics these days.
We're talking to Kathy Kramer, professor at UW-Madison and chairwoman of Badgers Vote, which works to help coordinate the university's voter education efforts. Kathy, let's talk about some practical challenges here. We've got elections in August, when a lot of students won't be on campus, and in November, when a lot of students will be on campus. How do they navigate that and even know which place they're supposed to vote in?
Oh, great question. And obviously, this time around, it's really tricky with the pandemic. So probably the best way for students to navigate what to do is to log on to the vote.wisc.edu page. So it's vote, period, WISC.edu. And on that page is a great tool that they can use, which the League of Women Voters helped us to develop. It's a decision tree where they log in and they answer questions, and it will direct them to how they need to go about registering to vote and voting by absentee, and depending on whether they're voting from home and whether that's in Wisconsin and not in Madison, or whether it's from another part of the country. But I should say, for your broader audience, anybody can log on to wi.gov and get information on these things as well, how to register, how to vote absentee. And another great resource I should let you know about is a League of Women Voters helpline that people can call, which is 608-285-2141. It's 608-285-2141. And people can have their questions answered as well.
Now, how about ID issues? What do you want to make sure students at whatever campus around the state know about what they need to vote?
Well, they need to understand that it's not necessarily the case that their student ID is sufficient. So there's two things that they need to be concerned about before Election Day. And one is registering. And they can register on the day of an election, but it's easier to get that out of the way ahead of time. But also that you need to show ID to vote in Wisconsin now. And it's complicated for students, because if you are, say, from out of state, but you are voting in Madison, you consider Madison to be your home now, you need a Wisconsin-approved ID. And your student ID might look like an official ID, but it doesn't necessarily count as a valid voting ID, and not at UW-Madison. There are four system schools where it is the case that it works. But at UW-Madison, you need to get a separate voter ID, which is issued on campus, and you also need to show proof of enrollment. Although that's a moving target too, because of a pending court case that by the time of the August election rolls around, or the November election rolls around, that may be different. So students need to sort of learn as early as possible whether they have an ID in hand that will work at the polls, and they should go and get one on campus if they don't have one. And they should also log into, again, our vote.wisc.edu page for the most updated information. And one other resource I will just share with you and your listeners is that if people, they can opt into a texting platform where we will be updating people in the moment, if there are changes in election laws or the way the elections are going to be administered. And so all they need to do is text the word Badgers Vote with a capital B and a capital V, and all one word, Badgers Vote, to 555-888. And that the texting platform is primarily for UW-Madison students, but anyone is welcome to text to that and get the updated information that we'll be sending out.
And Kathy, because of the work you do that we've talked to you a lot about over the years, you look a lot at kind of divisions between rural Wisconsin in particular and Madison. It occurs to me you work with a lot of students who are probably from rural and small town Wisconsin who then come to Madison to go to school. What a unique viewpoint, I imagine, for your research to see how the world looks like through their eyes.
Well, it's a real pleasure and a gift, that's for sure, to be able to encounter students from all across the state here at UW-Madison. And I guess the thing that I would say is that there's a feeling among a lot of students, regardless of where they're from, that their voices aren't heard in the political process. And so election season is a great time to step up and make sure that your voice is going to be heard. So make sure that you're registered and make sure you're ready to vote, because this is your right. And it's an exciting time where undoubtedly we have some pretty big decisions ahead of us as a country.
Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for focusing on this, and thanks for having me on.
That's Kathy Kramer, political science professor at UW-Madison, co-chair of Badgers Vote, which coordinates the university's voter education efforts. It gets competitive sometimes. The university and other campuses around the state are part of the All-In Campus Democracy Challenge. Coming up, we'll talk about COVID-19 and rules about face masks in Wisconsin's prison system. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we catch up on some of the week's top stories out of Washington with a White House reporter. First, the Wisconsin Department of Corrections will require staff at all of its prisons to wear face masks starting on Monday. That comes after months of making decisions about mask rules on a facility-by-facility basis. As of yesterday, 283 incarcerated people and 85 prison staff had tested positive for COVID-19. Most have recovered. No deaths have been reported, but prisons remain a vulnerable place for the spread of the virus. And for families of inmates, that can cause a lot of worry and uncertainty. Rory Linane is an Ideas Lab reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's been following this story. Rory, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Can you talk about some of the things that make prisons and inmates and their staff especially vulnerable to this coronavirus?
Yeah, definitely. So in doing this reporting, I talked with Dr. Anasia Safdar, who's the medical director of infection control at UW Health. And she pointed out a lot of factors. A big one is that people in prisons really don't have much control over social distancing from each other, especially in a lot of Wisconsin prisons where there's overcrowding. For example, in Waupun, where there was a big outbreak, it's at about 140% of capacity. So it's even more crowded than it's designed to be. Additionally, being in indoor spaces, often poorly ventilated indoor spaces, can be very dangerous. We've seen lately, with scientists have been stressing the risk of airborne transmission with smaller droplets that don't fall to the ground and can linger in the air for hours. So when you're sharing an indoor space with that stagnant air, that's really risky. And then also in the prisons, you have staff moving in and out every day, and you don't know who they're interacting with outside of their jobs. Additionally, some people have said inmates are scared to report if they have symptoms because some people are being quarantined in the same cells that are used for administrative segregation, also known as solitary confinement, so they don't necessarily want to have to go there. And inmates are more likely to have underlying health conditions like asthma and diabetes that put them at a higher risk for severe cases of COVID.
I know in other states around the country, people have pointed to some prisons as actual hotspots for COVID-19. I mentioned the numbers we've seen statewide. Are there any facilities so far that have been treated like hotspots or where there's been particular concern?
Yeah, the State Department of Corrections has been testing inmates and staff across the state. The biggest problem spot we've seen so far is Waupun Correctional Institute, where 228 inmates tested positive, and staff members have also tested positive. In addition to that, we've seen cases at several Milwaukee facilities, in Oshkosh, in Portage, and other locations as well.
Until this week, what had been the policy when it came to masks in prisons in the state?
Yeah, until this week, the Department of Corrections was implementing those requirements on a case-by-case basis. They wouldn't tell me exactly what the criteria were, but they were looking at community spread and other factors to determine where they would require that. But, you know, public health experts have pointed out that it's really important to wear masks as a preventative measure, especially for staff that could be bringing the virus in from outside. And so now, today, The Department of Administration has announced that all state employees across the board have to wear masks when they're inside state facilities. So that covers staff who are working in these Department of Corrections facilities.
Do we know about mask availability, even if they're not required for the inmates themselves?
Yes, I believe each inmate was supposed to be given 3 masks at least. And, you know, in some cases that may be difficult. It means they need to be able to launder them frequently. But in terms of the family members I spoke to, they felt like their loved ones inside did at least have access to 2 masks to be able to wear those.
We're talking to Rory Linane, Ideas Lab reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's been covering concerns about COVID-19 in Wisconsin's prison system, a new requirement, as you just heard, for masks to be worn by the staff at those facilities now. That's effective. That was just announced today. And Rory, you just mentioned you've been talking to relatives and partners of people who are incarcerated. Can you share some of the stories and concerns that they shared with you?
Yeah, it's really hard for them, especially right now, because they can't do in-person visits. And so a lot is really out of their control, and there's a lot they can't do for their loved ones. And they know that their loved ones are stuck somewhere, and they can't control whether they're social distancing and in sanitary environments. So a lot depends on how seriously the staff are taking this. And some said that even in places where staff are supposed to be wearing masks, the inmates have observed that they're not wearing masks. And even the loved ones themselves have observed in video visits that staff were not wearing masks, even though they were sharing the room with the inmates. And, you know, one person I talked to said her husband told her that the staff were actually joking about the virus, and that, you know, one staff member came in wearing a mask and then took it off and said he was just joking and put the mask in his pocket.
And we've been focusing on adult facilities so far. How about the youth prison at Lincoln Hills, which we've talked about a lot for other reasons over the years on the show? What do we know about youth facilities?
Yeah, originally the masks were not required at the youth facilities, but more recently, I think it was last week, or early this week, they started requiring staff to wear masks there as well.
In the early days of coronavirus, I understand there were some releases of nonviolent offenders, efforts to reduce, at least to some extent, crowding at facilities. How much of a difference does that seem to have made?
Yeah, that's one of the main steps that public health experts recommend, because it's the only way to make sure that people can stay safe. So the Governor Evers administration did say that there would be steps to release some people in certain situations, especially looking at people who were on supervised release and were incarcerating for violating rules of that release, and others with nonviolent criminal charges. The ACLU a couple weeks ago came out with a report that gave Wisconsin an F+ grade for its response to COVID in jails and prisons, and basically said that there hasn't been enough progress made with releasing folks from jails and prisons. But there is information on the DOC website about how people can petition for early release, especially if they're elderly or if they have certain health conditions.
Yeah, I saw you'd reported on that very low grade, F+, I guess not a very good grade. Have some of the concerns raised there, I guess in part with this now mask requirement, have some of the concerns raised there been addressed since that report came out?
I believe partially, yeah. Like the mask requirement is one example, because one aspect of that report was looking at the protective equipment available and required. The report also looked at doing testing, which DOC has committed to testing inmates and staff, but it'll be important for that to be done on an ongoing basis. And the report also looked at the availability of data. And if you go on the DOC website, doc.wi.gov, there is a dashboard for COVID where you can see how many staff and inmates have tested positive at each site.
What kind of things are you watching for now? This mask requirement, obviously a big development. What other kind of things are you watching for with the story of COVID-19 in Wisconsin's prisons?
Yeah, I think we'll want to keep an eye on how much testing there is going forward. Like I said, you know, public health officials say it's important to test on an ongoing basis, especially because the virus could be introduced at any time. They also say, you know, reducing the population is the thing that people stress the most. So we'll be looking at that as well.
And that mask mandate, when does that kick in? It was announced today, you mentioned.
Yes, that kicks in on Monday. And it applies not just in the DOC facilities, but all state employees who work in state facilities will have to wear masks when they are indoors.
Rory, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Rory Linane. She's an Ideas Lab reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She talked to us about efforts to slow the spread of COVID-19 in Wisconsin's prisons. The Wisconsin Corrections Department had been putting different rules in place at different facilities, but as we heard, staff at all prisons will be required to wear masks starting on Monday. Is this your story? Do you work at a correctional facility? Are you an inmate? Do you have a family or other loved ones incarcerated right now? What kind of concerns do you have about COVID-19? How is it affecting your ability to communicate with your loved ones? If you work there, how is it affecting your job? You could post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know, or you can email, share your story at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. And as always, you can tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up next here on Central Time, it's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Soongmin Kim is back with us, White House reporter for The Washington Post. We'll check out a bunch of stories, a lot going on, as it seems like it always is this week, including disbursements of federally backed loans to businesses around the country. 650,000 businesses and nonprofits, their names have been released as part of a transparency effort. We'll look at the impact of that. Check out the race to control the U.S. Senate and look at the argument over, yes, masks in national politics. All that's coming up on our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, parts of Wisconsin are under a heat advisory today, and the high temperatures have been going on a long time and are expected to continue. We'll talk to a meteorologist about what's behind the heat wave and when it might break. First, it's our weekly roundup of some of the top stories out of the nation's capital. Mexico's president is in Washington to promote the renegotiated trade agreement with the U.S. and Canada, but there's no Canada in the picture today. And we learned Monday about where a lot of the Paycheck Protection Program money went. Some of the recipients surprised some people. Those are a few of the stories we'll be talking about, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you check out this list of loan recipients in this Paycheck Protection Program? What stood out to you? Did it go to you? Did your business benefit from it? If so, let us know and how it helped you, if at all. Or did you apply and didn't find success in getting that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Soongmin Kim is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Soongmin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this international visit. Now, with COVID, world leaders aren't always getting together all that much. Now, we've got Mexico's Andrés Manuel López Obrador at the White House today talking about the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal going into effect. What's behind this visit? What are the interests on each side here?
There's actually been a, this visit has been really fascinating to watch. It's the second in a few weeks of a foreign leader visiting the White House, which a lot of international, as we know, has been stopped because of the coronavirus pandemic. But it comes at an interesting time. It's actually the Mexican president's first foreign trip, you know, into the United States or just anywhere outside Mexico as the Mexican president. So it is interesting that AMLO, as he is, you know, commonly called, would choose the United States as kind of his first place of his own foreign trip throughout his presidency. As we know, the president had made disparaging comments about Mexicans during his presidential campaign. He falsely repeatedly said that he would get Mexico to pay for a border wall, a promise that he clearly has not kept and has struggled to build the wall even. But the trade agreement that the both presidents touted today is something that has been a major, victory for both presidents. And actually, you know, all three presidents in the three countries that are involved. Canada's Justin Trudeau obviously did not choose to come to Washington today as part of this agreement, citing the pandemic. But you see how the Trump campaign has promoted this new trade agreement in their campaign messaging earlier today. This is expected to help, in those key Midwestern states where access to goods, especially for those farmers, is opened up. And so this is a key legislative win for the Trump administration. But as always, a lot of these victories do get overshadowed by the controversies of the day, whether it's the president's comments or his ongoing handling of the pandemic. So it's one of several things that the White House is grappling with at this moment.
And then, as I mentioned, the Paycheck Protection Program, the list of recipients released, 650,000 businesses and nonprofits, that list released by the Treasury Department, including the dollar amount range of the loans. A lot of people going through this with a fine-toothed comb, trying to figure out where the money went, who the recipients were. And they were all over the place, right? Like a lot of different kinds of businesses and groups here.
A lot of different kinds of groups and businesses, and a lot of different groups and businesses that you could make an argument perhaps shouldn't have gotten government assistance. So my colleagues at the Washington Post analyzed that data released Monday, and it showed that, you know, at least half a dozen businesses with ties to members of Congress who you remember wrote and voted on that legislation, and also the law firm that represented President Trump, were among the hundreds of thousands of firms that got this government-backed aid that was meant to protect small businesses. I think a lot of that data, which only really came after the public disclosure, only really came after a lot of public pressure from news organizations and various interest groups, I think will help guide Congress in the next round of coronavirus relief packages if they do want to expand this program, the Paycheck Protection Program, somewhat, because in their haste haste to write this emergency rescue legislation, you know, there are a lot of there are a lot of places that, you know, lawmakers say will need to be tweaked or requirements that will need to be revised. I think one interesting point was that nearly 90,000 companies in the program took the aid without promising, literally on their applications, that they would rehire workers or create jobs, which was the whole intent of the program, that they would keep workers on the payroll. We talked about the connection to members of Congress. There were also businesses with ties to members of the administration, whether it's the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, or Treasury Secretary Elaine Chao, that benefited from this program. Now, you know, spokespeople for them say they had no knowledge of those companies getting the assistance. But there are a lot of, these overlapping interests that we've seen just from this very, very vast, big program.
Does it look like anybody's trying to take names from this list and run with it as a political football at this point?
That's actually emerging in a lot of the Senate races, which obviously has been a little bit more under the radar than, you know, obviously the presidential campaign. But there are a handful of Senate Democratic candidates who had been a little bit critical of the Paycheck Protection Program, whether it's the disclosure requirements or whatnot. But after we saw the data released today, there were a handful of candidates who similarly had businesses that they had some sort of ties to benefit from the program. And Republican candidates and Republican senators have seized on that as, you know, hypocrisy of sorts. And I think it just goes to show that a program this vast, this wide, are going to have kind of these overlapping conflict or conflicts or a semblance or an appearance of conflict. And I think that's something that lawmakers are going to more closely watch in the future.
We're talking to Seungmin Kim from The Washington Post, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's stay on those Senate races, Seungmin. You know, the presidential race, like you said, getting a lot of attention, but as happens every 2 years, a third of the Senate up for grabs. Wisconsin, we've got a bye week this time. We don't have either of our seats up. But give us the lay of the land. And Democrats have the minority in the Senate now. They need some pickups. What is the big picture here?
So big picture is Republicans are feeling very nervous right now about their prospects of retaining Senate control. It was always going to be not too easy for Republicans to retain control of the Senate. They are largely playing defense. They hold 53 seats currently to the Democrats 47. So, and there are a lot of Republican senators who are currently holding seats where either Hillary Clinton won in 2016 or the president won narrowly or are definitely considered swing states this time around. We're talking about Colorado and Maine, where Cory Gardner and Susan Collins are in tough reelection bids. And we're also talking about states such as Iowa, North Carolina, and Arizona, where the president won in 2016, but clearly are very competitive states, both on the presidential level and on the Senate level this time around. Republican senators are worried about a number of things, but a lot of the dynamics are similar to the president right now, with the focus so much on the president's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, to the sinking economy, to the president's handling of the racial and civil unrest that we've seen all over the country, and the other kind of the related controversies that the president seems to ignite, whether it's over Confederacy symbols or whatnot. The focus is so much on the party in power, and that's what's concerning Republicans right now. Another concerning data point for Republican senators is that there is a lot of enthusiasm on the grassroots level for Democratic candidates right now. You've had one Democratic challenger after another raise record-breaking sums in the second quarter of this year, which is the quarter that ran from April 1st to June 30th. There are Democratic challengers in red states such as Kentucky and South Carolina that are pulling in double-digit million-dollar sums, which are astronomical amounts. There are a lot of it powered by small dollars, which means, you know, donors can contribute again, and that Democrats, they really show this grassroots enthusiasm for getting Republican senators out of office.
Now, I know in the presidential election, Wisconsin is a favorite to be the key swing state in a close election. Is there a Senate seat or two that people are really looking at as a hotly competitive, the bellwethers for the whole thing?
There are a lot that you can choose from at this point, because if you think about it, obviously there is a Senate race in Alabama that is kind of the one race on the radar that Republicans are expected to pick up. But you're looking at a number of states, whether it's Maine or North Carolina or Iowa, that could be the tipping point for Democrats to get the 50 or the 51 or the 50 if Biden wins the presidency. That majority making state. So a lot of it focuses, you know, a lot of these senators are also in their first terms, with the exception of Susan Collins of Maine, who is a longtime veteran senator. You know, most of these Republicans who are in these competitive states are Republicans who won in that big class of 2014 that put Mitch McConnell as majority leader 6 years ago. So these are senators who don't have a lengthy record in Washington, who are still trying to introduce themselves to voters. And on top of the races that we discussed, another very interesting race to be watching is Montana, because we know that it's obviously a red state, a Trump-loving state. But Republican Senator Steve Daines there got himself a very formidable challenger when Governor Steve Bullock, who by virtue of being governor has shown that he can win statewide in a red state, got in the race earlier this year, even though he had said several times that during his short presidential bid that he would not run. But Bullock, because of his recognition statewide, his appeal to Trump voters, and his ability to fundraise a lot, has become a really, like I said, a formidable challenger to Senator Daines, and really put Montana on the map, which is remarkable in an election year.
We're talking with Washington Post White House reporter Seungmin Kim. It's the week in Washington. Coming up, we'll look at federal guidance on COVID-19 related issues, including what we're hearing from the White House and prominent Republican leaders on the issue of, should you wear a mask? Should you go to big events like political conventions? And what should happen with schools this fall? You can join in at 800-642-1234. When it comes to messages, maybe even policies related to COVID-19, what do you want to hear right now from the White House, from presidential candidates, from Congress? What kind of example do you want to see them set? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Washington Post White House reporter Seungmin Kim about some of the week's top stories out of Washington. Seungmin, you wrote about masks and Republicans, leading Republicans, kind of embracing the mask message, even as the president is not buying in wholeheartedly. What's going on?
So that's been one really interesting point of divide between President Trump and, frankly, the rest of his party. We know from public health officials and members of his own administration, medical experts, that putting a covering over your nose and mouth is one of the most effective ways of trying to contain the spread of the virus, especially as, you know, people, as the economy continues reopenings and people start to go out, get a lot of, try to kick the cabin fever that we've had over the last several months. But the president, for various reasons, several times has repeatedly said he would not, repeatedly refused to wear a mask in public. Now, the White House has said that he is the most tested man in America, and I would say that's probably accurate, and that people around him are tested regularly for COVID, and that he doesn't need to be wearing a mask. But there's something that a president does, and that is to set an example for the rest of the public. And you've seen, especially with public opinion, very, you know, much in favor of, you know, wearing those protective coverings to spread, to stop the spread. You've seen other Republicans kind of step up this kind of public health message and urging the public to wear masks. I did find it interesting that even Vice President Pence does make it a point to regularly wear masks, whether it's at a press briefing or traveling, even if he does take it off to speak to reporters or for photo ops or whatnot. And some of the most most ardent, you know, advocates, proponents of wearing a mask have come from Republican senators. One in particular is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. When he's been back home, he's been repeatedly urging the public to wear a mask. He wears a Washington Nationals, a baseball mask on the Capitol at times. And he's really been emphasizing that he is a polio survivor. He has been focused on this. And you've seen a lot of Republican senators, whether through Twitter or Instagram, or and also just in their public appearances, and then obviously just by their own actions, emphasize how important mask wearing is. And it really is a minority of lawmakers on Capitol Hill who regularly have not worn masks.
On a related note, we have some Republican senators say they're not going to the Republican National Convention, the part of it that's going to be in Florida. It's been a kind of a winding road here as to where this thing is going to be and how much is going to be in Charlotte, how much is going to be in Florida. But can you talk about some of the Republican senators saying they're going to sit this one out, especially with what's going on in Florida with COVID-19?
Definitely. I mean, one senator in particular who we're really looking as, you know, has really been a focus in terms of the coronavirus not being a reason for or being a reason for him not being able to attend, is Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa. He is the second oldest member of the Senate. He is 86 years old. He has attended, obviously, many, many conventions in years past. He is not up for re-election this year, so he doesn't have to be home campaigning. But he says he's just not going to go. And you do have several other senators, for various other reasons, say they will, you know, not be attending. You know, Susan Collins, like we discussed earlier in the show, she is up for re-election, so she generally doesn't attend conventions if she is up for re-election. Senator Mitt Romney, who is probably the most prominent Trump critic among Republicans on Capitol Hill, won't be attending either. He didn't attend in 2016, so that's not too much of a surprise. But what's been interesting is the lack of response that we've been getting from Republican senators on whether they actually are attending. You know, in any other year, it probably would be a given that political figures as prominent as members of the U.S. Senate would attend their party's convention. But the fact that very few are kind of running out and confirming that they will indeed be in Jacksonville really underscores that concern, that public health concern that Republican senators have, or that of being in enclosed spaces or being in an area that is considered a COVID hotspot with a lot of other people. The president did kind of give himself an out in an interview earlier this week, saying he would be, quote, flexible with potential convention plans. But this has already been moved once from Charlotte, North Carolina, because of the COVID situation. And it is definitely, nothing is assured at this point as to whether this convention goes off in a way that Trump wants, which is with the big pageantry and the thousands of people, which is the whole reason why this convention was moved to Florida in the first place.
We're talking to Seungmin Kim from The Washington Post, looking at the big stories in national politics today. I want to throw one more at you, Seungmin, that's been developing today. One of the big questions now with COVID-19 is when and how do schools reopen? We're going to talk about that with a Wisconsin pediatrician, by the way, on the show tomorrow at 4:30. The CDC had guidelines out. The president criticized them. Now Vice President Pence says the CDC is going to change the recommendations. Quoting Vice President Pence, he said, "We just don't want the guidance to be too tough." What are you watching with this, with the signals the White House is sending on school reopening?
I'm watching to see what sort of resources they're willing to provide to state and local governments to be able to reopen schools properly. And the fact is, you've heard estimates and different experts have talked about all the additional funding that schools would need to for extra staffing, for extra sanitation, to be able to have classes in the fall. So is the administration going to be able to be willing to kind of offer that extra funding to individual school governments? You know, we've seen comments from administration officials earlier today that they'd be withholding funding. Is that even legally plausible? What are the problems with the guidelines that the CDC laid out? I think those are all questions that the administration and particularly members of Congress will have to address in the coming weeks. Right now, members of Congress are back home in their districts during a two-week summer break, but they will come back later in July, and they will almost surely pass another coronavirus rescue package. And it is expected to be smaller in size than the $3 trillion CARES package that passed earlier this year. But a big focus of whatever passes Congress is how you deal with the school situation, how to get them safely reopened. Do they have enough resources and do they have enough guidance from the federal government to be able to, you know, to be able to reopen properly? And that's a question that we don't quite know the answer to yet. But the discord between the president and his own administration, which we've seen a lot, was just remarkable today. Education and school reopenings has been a focus for the administration this week. But the fact that the president kind of goes out there and contradicts the CDC on Twitter, saying their guidelines are too tough and too expensive, and Vice President Pence kind of has to go in the press briefing later that day and says, yes, they were being revised after the president came out on Twitter and criticized the guidelines, it was a really remarkable move earlier today.
In our last few moments, Seungmin, probably the big story tomorrow is something we don't even know about yet, but what do you have your eye on right now?
Well, the one big thing to watch is something that we watch at the end of every June, which is what the Supreme Court is going to be doing. there have been a lot of blockbuster cases, whether it's on immigration, gay rights. You just had another big ruling on the Affordable Care Act and their contraceptive mandates today. But the Supreme Court is going to announce tomorrow morning whether Congress can see President Trump's personal financial records. We know that the president has not been fully as transparent as other presidents in terms of his tax returns, his financial records. But that is a case that has been waged all the way up to the Supreme Court. And tomorrow is the last day that opinions will be issued. So we know for sure that the decision on Trump's tax returns will come tomorrow morning, and that will be that whatever the court decides will definitely drive the news cycle tomorrow.
We'll watch for that. Seungmin, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Seungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post. She joined us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. And again, more on schools tomorrow on Central Time. One great thing about this time of year, even if it's on the hot side this time around, berries have been popping up all over the place. As I mentioned a while back, we've had some service berries come along in our backyard, and I've learned that they're edible. And I've learned you can make simple syrup with service berries, which is great in iced tea and smoothies and other drinks. Currants are popping up in CSA farm shares and elsewhere, I hear. That's great news if you like currants. And raspberries, some of them are coming along. We have some in the backyard. I've seen great pictures of people sharing a pretty good harvest so far online. We're going to talk about cooking, baking, and more with all those berries. That's the current plan for this week's edition of Food Friday. And we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite seasonal berry? What do you like to do with it? Drinks, desserts, salads, or just eat it? Send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know your favorite berry and what you like to do with it for our Food Friday edition this week. I should mention my favorite seasonal berry, the mulberry. I grew up with a tree in the backyard. There's lots of trees around, and you could spot them now by the purple smear on the sidewalk underneath. I wouldn't take fruit off of somebody else's tree in general, but the mulberry is special because if it's ripe and ready to eat now, it's going to be mush on the ground in 5 or 10 minutes. So I feel like I'm okay eating the ones hanging over the sidewalk. I've been made fun of, actually, in public for doing it over parking lots and whatnot. Berries coming up on Food Friday. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.